This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Steve Gilbert, director and founder of the Institute of Neurotoxicology and Neurological Disorders, an affiliate professor in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences at the University of Washington. Steve is author of the book, A Small Dose of Toxicology, The Health Effects of Common Chemicals, and has developed a website, Toxipedia, with a mission of connecting science and people. Steve Gilbert is here today to tell us about the health effects of lead and our successes and failures as a society to prevent toxic exposures. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you, Dan. It's great to be here.
What is the history of lead? How did we come to use it and for what?
Well, that's a good start-off question. We've known about lead for a long time. They were used in the Roman Empire as far as plumbing goes. And 2,000 years ago, it was recorded that one of their physicians said, lead makes the mind give way. So we've known for two millennia that lead is not good for us in our developing brains. And from there, it was used in a variety of products. We could run down a list of, you know, plumbing is one of them. It was added to gasoline. It was added to paint. And I want to just point out, in paint, we did not remove lead from paint until 1978. But in Europe, it was removed in the 20s by the League of Nations. So some people have taken a very precautionary approach to lead. The United States has not.
What are the health effects of lead exposure?
Well, health effects of lead exposure vary. I think most importantly, we know that there's no safe level of lead exposure. You know, no matter how much you have, it's not good for you. But, and that's pretty important for kids. Kids are very sensitive to lead because of developing nervous systems. And I also want to point out that children absorb about 50% of the lead they ingest. So lead comes in water or it comes as a food source, they ingest the lead. They absorb about 50% versus adults only absorb about 10%. So children are not little adults. They have much more sensitive to the effects of lead and lead exposure. So even small amounts of it cause neurological disorders, drop in IQ and difficulty reading. Basically, they lose some of their abilities and they do not reach to maintain their full potential.
How much of a difference is there between adults and children in terms of the effects?
You know, there are quite a bit of differences. Kids are affected for a lifetime. And adults, there is some effect on adults. It's not as noticeable. But I think that we need to look at that more closely. And we know that lead affects adults, too. At higher levels, it causes nausea and vomiting and causes the same neurological disorders as with kids. So it's not good.
What groups of people are most at risk for lead exposure in addition to children?
I think people that are in poor neighborhoods are really more susceptible to lead exposure, probably because their housing has got lead in it. And it's an environmental justice issue. You live along roads, really busy streets. At one time, we had a lot of cars and other vehicles with lead in them. And this lead got into the environment in that section, too, and on the soil there on the ground. So and those often tend to be the cheaper housing. So it's people that are poor and that they just get one more problem added on. It's stress. You add stress to lead exposure, you get more greater decrement. And I think that we need to be asking the question of who is most vulnerable, and it's people of color and poor people. And that is something we as a society really need to address.
Where does lead end up in our bodies when we're exposed?
When we're exposed to lead, lead first goes to the bloodstream. But because lead substitutes for calcium is incorporated into bone, so that's a little exposure when you're young can lead to a lifetime of concentration of lead in the bone. And then it gradually moves out of the bone as you develop. And that's one reason kids absorb so much more lead than adults do, is because they have the lead exposure and it's incorporated in their bone. And as they're growing, they need more calcium. They absorb more lead.
You've said a bit about this already, but what are the main sources of lead exposure? Would you go into more detail?
So there are multiple sources, and recently the Washington State Department of Ecology looked at lead in jewelry as one source, and that's detrimental because kids will put that in their mouths and potentially swallow the jewelry, and then jewelry is made out of lead because it's cheap and easy to do. Lead paint has been a huge one. I think that's one of the most important sources. And like I mentioned, lead paint was not banned until 1978. In the United States, Washington State, we don't know how much lead paint there is on the housing, but that's a really important one. Lead and gasoline was important, and that was really distributed a lot of lead around the environment. Probably the greatest public health mistake made was putting lead in gasoline. We've heard about toys coming with lead on them. Ethnic Remedies is another source of lead. Piping, you know, we had Flint, Michigan, which is a horrible example of people not paying attention to stuff we know. I think one thing I really want to emphasize is that we know so much about lead, and we know what the health consequences are, and we know what we, quote unquote, should be doing about lead exposure and trying to reduce it. Lead has been used everywhere. It's been used in solder. It's used in electronic gear. So there are many, many different uses for lead.
Would you say more about the issue of lead in water, since that has been a recent issue in Flint, Michigan? Say more about exactly how the lead comes into the water from pipes and what can be done to prevent that from happening.
Yeah, that's a good question. The lead is in pipes. Galvanized pipes have a little bit of lead in them. And we have corrosion control. So our methods to try to help keep the lead in place. But Flint, Michigan, they changed their water supply, as you know, and they gave it much more corrosive material, and they did not put the corrosion protection chemicals in the water, and therefore the lead came off the lead pipes and it increased contamination for children and homes. Many older homes will have lead pipes that connect to the main water supply, and those things need to be redone. We have a society that is not invested in our children. We need to invest to remove those things. There's no reason they cannot be removed, and getting the lead out of the pipes is really important. And we also need to reduce, we have reduced the amount of lead that's allowed in fixtures, and that's also been really good.
In terms of lead in water, we know that Flint has a problem, but what about other cities?
Well, yeah, I think that a lot of other cities have had that. You look at Washington, D.C. has had a problem. Seattle had a problem in their school system about 7 or 8 years ago. So this is not an unusual problem. We know about lead as a source of exposure, and in the water supply is just one of those areas. Lead also from smelters in the area, the Tacoma smelter put lead out in the environment and the soil in the area. So there are many different sources of lead, and lead in water is quite common. But the thing is, we know how to deal with it with corrosion control, with the pipes and the chemicals. The chemicals are relatively cheap.
Blood tests are a common way of testing for lead. What levels of lead in blood are of concern?
Right now, the Center for Disease Control sets a reference level of approximately 5 micrograms per deciliter. And that was lowered, and I think it was 2012, from 10 to 5, which is a big deal. But in 2006, I wrote a paper where we argued that lead should be lowered to a blood lead action level of 2 micrograms per deciliter. My own view is that anything above 2, you have some environmental exposure to lead that you should be looking at. And that was not accepted by the Center for Disease Control. But I think we need to be looking at lead at that level. Because if there is increased lead of 2, you should be paying attention to that and asking, where's the lead coming from? Certainly, 5 micrograms per deciliter, you want to ask that question. Is it coming home from occupational exposure? Is it in the water? Is it in the paint from the home? What is the source of lead and where's it coming from? And I think the other thing that has been really important is we've had in the last 10 years real advances in blood lead analysis. So it's much cheaper to look for blood lead levels, and it's also cheaper to look for it in products with XRF equipment.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Steve Gilbert, director and founder of the Institute of Neurotoxicology and Neurological Disorders, an affiliate professor in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences at the University of Washington. Our topic is the health effects of lead and our success and failures as a society to prevent toxic exposures. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. To what extent are there elevated levels of lead found in children nationwide that are above the 5 micrograms per deciliter that CDC considers of concern?
For example, you look at Flint, Michigan. Flint had about 2% or so, and it varies from state to state. Look at Iowa and New Hampshire, I think they have the highest kids' blood leads. The other thing you have to do is testing for that. Not all the states do. In Washington State, for example, only tests about 3 or 4% of their kids for elevated blood leads. So that's a very low percent. Other states are up around 50% of their kids are being tested. So it varies quite a bit. And, you know, we don't know. We certainly don't know in Washington State percent of kids with elevated blood leads. And I think the other thing you have to remember is you got to look at, is it elevated from 5 to 10, or is it from 10 and above? And when your blood leads increase from 0 to 10, you lose more IQ points, have greater neurological damage. then your blood leads go from 10 to 20. So it's that first exposure is really critical to stop and make sure we're not exposing our kids to any lead or at the least little as possible. And I always encourage people to get the data from the kids and find out exactly what it is. And it's above 2, look around where it might be coming from. It's above 5, then you really need to help. And our public health people should be intervening in that.
So how much progress have we made over time in the United States in reducing the blood levels of lead?
Well, you know, in some ways made a lot of progress in general because we've dropped the average blood lead for kids down. And when I say broadly average, the average blood lead now is like 1.3, 1.5 micrograms per deciliter. But we have not reduced the number of kids that have blood leads greater than 10 or even from 5 to 9. On the average, we've done that. But there are a lot of spots that kids have increased lead levels that we have not reduced. So you look at Washington State, for example. In the last 5-6 years, we have not really made much progress in reducing the number of children that we catch that have blood leads greater than 5. And certainly greater than 10, we have not reduced the number of kids. And if you get your blood lead up above 10, you are definitely going to have problems of intellectual capability throughout your lifespan. So I think on aggregate, we've made great progress. Individually, we have not. And we need to focus on those kids. Look at Flint, Michigan, for it's a great example of that. In general, they said they had, prior to the Flint water crisis, they had the average blood leads was elevated, had about 2%. And then they said, well, it only increased to 4%. Yes, but you look at who, on the average, you look at hot spots in that, and the communities that had poor housing, they had other issues in their area, the number of children with elevated bloods increased from 2 to 10. So it increased dramatically. So I think we've done a good job in aggregate. We've done a terrible job of picking up kids that are most vulnerable.
What kind of treatment is there for lead toxicity other than removing lead from the environment?
There really is no good treatment for lead toxicity unless you have really high levels and then they can chelate the blood lead. And chelation means you have chemicals that will help excretion of lead. But in general, you don't want to do that unless your blood lead levels are really elevated, like above 40. So that's very rare anymore, thank goodness. But I still think that we need to be really aware, because there's no good treatment for lead. You get exposed to lead, and you have a lifetime of decrement in your intellectual abilities.
Under what circumstances should children be tested for lead?
I think that if you have any indication there might be exposure in your environment, your house is old, you have older homes, you're near a smelter, an old smelter, you should be tested for lead. But I think in general, there are rules that in Medicaid, you're supposed to have kids tested at least twice at 1, 2, and 3 years of age in that age bracket. And I think it's really important to be able to do that at that time to find out, is there elevated lead? So I think there should be more broad testing because it could be coming from home. It could be a hobby. You could be making bullets at home and smelting lead at home, basically, and that will increase exposure. You could be using leaded glass windows, for example, in the home, and those children will be exposed to lead. If you're working in construction, you might be stripping lead-based paint off a bridge or something, and you bring the lead home. So it's really important to keep it testing because there is still a lot of lead in the environment that our kids can be exposed to.
So would you say that all children should be tested for lead?
Myself, I would do that. I would test all kids for lead. Until we have lead really under control, then we should be testing everybody. I would just say blanket everybody, and it's just not that expensive anymore.
Would you say more about our testing or not testing for lead in children in Washington State, kind of the history of that and where things stand now?
Well, you know, in some ways, things haven't changed a whole lot in the last decade or so. So the rule is that lead testing of kids on Medicaid is mandatory. In Washington State, basically ignored that rule for the last decade, couple decades. We have a long history of the physicians not being really that concerned about lead exposure because some physicians argued that it was not a big deal. It was not that detrimental to the kids. But as we gathered more data and understanding, we realized that even a small amount of lead exposure is detrimental to developing nervous system. But you can't look at a kid that's been exposed to low levels of lead exposure and know how much lead or if that was detrimental. The only way you can do that is on a population basis. You know, like I grew up in the 50s. And exposed to lead through gasoline and other things, I probably had elevated lead. And if I had all my IQ points, I might have been full professor. Who knows? You know, but it's tough to figure out on an individual basis. But on a population basis, you can calculate that. and look at the decrement of IQ points. You look at how much that costs society as far as not being able to have good ideas or needing remedial attention in school systems. And a really good report just came out in Michigan right before the Flint thing that tried to look at the cost of lead. It was also done in Washington State. Department of Ecology has looked at some of these issues, and they did a lead chemical action plan several years ago to try to assess lead in Washington State.
Overall, how well is Washington State dealing with the issue of lead exposure?
You know, I don't think they're dealing with it that well, partly because they're not testing for it. I think there are programs in King County and Department of Health, Department of Ecology, Washington State is dealing with it. And this report that just came out looking at jewelry in the state indicates that we are testing for lead. But, you know, I think that in general, we've got to keep the funding there. We've got to keep looking for lead and get lead out of housing. I think housing is a huge issue, probably because it's an environmental justice issue. People that live in poor, dilapidated housing also have trouble in schools. Schools might not be up to par. And it just adds on lead. It's just another detrimental thing for development that puts people behind for a lifetime.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Steve Gilbert, director and founder of the Institute of Neurotoxicology and Neurological Disorders, and affiliate professor in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences at the University of Washington. Our topic is the health effects of lead and our success and failures as a society to prevent toxic exposures. What are the main sources of occupational exposure to lead? You said a bit about that earlier.
Washington State, through Labor and Industries in Washington State, is looking at lead exposure to adults and workplace exposures and asking a question, should they have removal faster and lower the blood lead action levels? I personally think that we need to stop this dichotomy between adults and kids, and we should have one standard, and that standard should be 5 micrograms per deciliter. If your blood lead's above 5, we need to get it down. We need to understand why. And I say that because, you know, adults come in males and females are particularly susceptible. So I mentioned lead substitutes for calcium goes into the bone. And if a woman has an elevated blood lead and she gets pregnant, that fetus is going to be subject to the lead exposure she has, because the fetus is basically a sink for calcium. They're growing rapidly. They need that calcium. And a woman's absorption of lead increases up to that 50% range during pregnancy because the woman's body needs more calcium to develop. And if they're exposed when they're kids or when they're younger, the lead will be leached out of the bones and then get into the kid. So we need to have standards that protect the most vulnerable society, which are young kids and women that are childbearing age. So I think that Washington State, through the labor industry, is taking a good look at that. Like I mentioned, I would drop them down to the same level, and that's what I'm arguing. But some people argue, well, that's too expensive, and, you know, as a workplace hazard, it's not that great anymore. We know how to control for it. And it's still used in bridges. It's still, paint is the big one in that area, and some soil contamination. But paint is the big one, removal of paint for occupational exposures, whether it's big bridges or it's older furniture and things like that. And it's manufactured lead. Scrap battery places or dealing with old electronics has a lot of lead in it. So lead just pops up all over the place, and we need to be really conscious of that, and I think in the future, move away from lead.
What safeguards are there to prevent occupational exposure?
Well, I think there are safeguards. There are best practices. For example, in older homes might have lead in them. The EPA requires lead abatement plan, and lead exposure is to be controlled so it doesn't get off the home into the yard, and you have good personal protective equipment for workers to deal with lead exposure. So that's pretty good rules, and that's been a big plus, is trying to remove lead from the homes and having good standards about that. I think we could do better around leaded fishing sinkers. I personally believe that we should remove lead from bullets and guns, and we have good substitutes for that, and we just need to stop spraying lead around the environment. You look at firing ranges, another potential lead exposure source, and that's firing ranges at the police, and others use our civil servants use, as well as just amateur shooting ranges. And there's been several incidents of shooting ranges that had the workers in the facilities had elevated lead levels, took some of that lead home. So we need to constantly be looking for what's the source of lead. And each area has its own special requirements, its own special needs to have control of potential lead exposure.
What are some successes in dealing with threats from lead exposure, ones that you would highlight?
I think I would highlight the fact that we have tried really hard to get lead in jewelry under control and lead in candy under control. Oh, there's still incidents. There's just a recent one the Department of Ecology found where there's lead in jewelry again, but we have gotten that under control. So I think that's really good. And I think the other one's been housing. There has been continued focus on housing and trying to get lead out of old paint, out of old housing. I think we've got to continue to work on that. And I think I would really would like to see our departments of health and public health have more response to families that have elevated lead. If your kid's blood lead goes above 5, Department of Health needs to come in and we need to help you understand where the lead source might be and reduce the lead exposure. The half-life of lead in the blood is about a month long, so it drops fairly quickly if you stop exposure. So the most important thing about lead is stop the exposure.
What do you think is preventing society from doing more to prevent lead exposure?
I think it's really just lack of investment. You know, we chronically have this problem. Our schools are older now. They have lead fixtures in them. And you see around the country schools popping up with increased lead levels in the drinking water. And you got to remember, schools are a little bit strange because some of the drinking fountains can be a long way from the source of water. If the water sits in these old leaded pipes, has a greater incidence of getting elevated lead in the water. So it's tough business.
Well, you said a bit about this already, but what would you say are the best steps society can take to prevent lead exposure overall, the most important ones?
The most important ones now, I think it comes back to lead and paint. We still have a lot of housing that has not been renovated that has lead in the paint, and that's probably the most common exposure. It's a little bit of dust from the windowsills or dust from the yards or just general lead like that. I think we need to attack the housing issue and know where the lead is and get it out of there. And we need to test more kids. If you look at the testing in Washington State, we don't test counties that have a lot of older housing in them. We're not testing for that. And I think the occupational exposure is also important. Now we need to chronically be looking at that, making sure that the workers are not exposed to lead and certainly not bring it home. Housing is a really critical one, and then looking at occupational exposures, whether it's firing ranges or it's manufacturing issues or it's scrapping things out or it's old battery recycling plants, you know, we need to be just vigilant about lead.
What are the most important steps for individuals in their own homes to minimize exposure to lead?
The most important things to do is take out your shoes when you come into the house because you don't want to track in lead or other stuff on the bottom of your shoes, and wash your hands. And I think those are the two most important things individuals can do. I think you just have to be aware of where the source might be. Leaded jewelry, be really cautious about buying secondhand jewelry, things like that. And cheap jewelry is more likely to have lead in it. So you just have to be sort of vigilant about that stuff. But we also have to fund our Department of Health, Department of Ecology's adequately so they can address lead in our society. Because it is a broad issue. And you look at something like Flint. We should not be having things like Flint happen. There's just no excuse for those. It really is a societal crime that occurred, and we need to be vigilant about those things. And everybody has to be aware that lead is really detrimental to the health and well-being of our children.
If you're worried that some jewelry you have or some other product might have lead, how can you find out whether it does have lead?
There are little test kits you can buy in hardware stores. You can also look around for an XRF equipment. Some of the NGOs will have them, Washington Toxics Coalition, for example, or other facilities, or you can ask the EPA. So you just have to hunt around to get your jewelry tested. Or old toys, and sometimes they'll have testing days. You can take these materials to a testing facility, and they'll test the quantity of lead materials to these XRF equipment. So it's relatively cheap and easy to do. It just takes seconds, literally a minute or less, to get a toy tested and just scan the toy or the jewelry and find out if they have lead in them.
We've been speaking predominantly about the United States, but how does our dealing with threats from lead compare to the rest of the world, Europe, and then on the other hand, developing countries?
Well, developing countries, lead is a serious threat. For example, dismantling their old electronic equipment is a real big issue. We outsource a bunch of that stuff, and we should not be doing that. Mining is another huge issue. There's gold mining in Nigeria, for example. It's killed a whole bunch of people. from the lead that comes along with the gold ore. And it contaminates the children and the adults too, and they end up dying, some of them, as well as just the lack of ability to think, remember, and really contribute to society. So lead mining is probably the biggest hazard around the world, and recycling material. Well, it's old. Think of your batteries. How many cars we have, and all the batteries in cars. There's enormous quantities of lead. We use lead all over the place, and we ship them now. Sometimes I was in Gaza for a while. I saw pictures of a lead battery dismantling place, and it's just right out in the middle of the neighborhood, which is really sad because you know that lead is getting out in the environment, into the soil, and causing issues.
How about the U.S. compared to Europe in terms of dealing with exposure to lead?
Yeah, U.S. and Europe, I think the big advantage Europe had was they banned lead-based paint in the 20s. So they did not have this whole huge housing stock with leaded paint in it. So in that sense, Europe did a lot better. They took a much more precautionary approach to lead. Getting lead out of gasoline was a big deal, and that was a huge public health move in the right direction. And countries have taken various stances. Europe was a little bit slower. The United States got rid of it in the 1990s, 88. We really got most of it out of our gasoline. And the average blood lead across the United States dropped from like 13 down to 5 and continued to drop down. So getting lead out of gasoline was a huge issue, and that was a worldwide issue. And Europe was a little bit slower. Some countries still have lead in their gasoline, but it's pretty much gone from most of the world. I was going to say one instance I had when I was in Gaza, because the power supply is irregular, they had those backup generators, and they used leaded gasoline in the backup generators. And the backup generators are on the sidewalks. The kids are running around, and that's their breathing level, and they're exposed to lead through these backup generators that are using leaded gasoline. So there's still instances like that. To me, that is a huge criminal act almost, you know, that we should not allow those things to happen. But the whole idea is we do not want to have chemicals that may damage the potential of our children.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think the big question and the big concern I have, we need to be thinking about the ethics of this. We need to be ensuring we have an ethical responsibility to our children to ensure that they have an environment where they can reach and maintain their full potential, and they were not giving them short shrift and exposure to chemicals like lead that we know cause intellectual decrements and really affect them for a lifetime. There's also good data to support that children that are exposed to lead have increased propensity for crime and potentially violent crime. There's really great data on that. And that has long-term effects on society, very costly to deal with. So I think in general, we need to be really focused on lead as a worldwide issue for our children and the future of their health and well-being.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Steve.
You're very welcome. Thanks, Dan. Thanks for taking the subject on.
You were just listening to Steve Gilbert, director and founder of the Institute of Neurotoxicology and Neurological Disorders and affiliate professor in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences at the University of Washington. For more information, check on the web at toxopedia.org. Again, that's toxopedia.org. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM by mobile app and on KEXP.org.